This is last week's share and last week's source page. And I think I shared with you this image that was in the source pages, which is essentially a depiction of kind of a graphic depiction or an artist depiction of this chapter that we are addressing, which is the statue of Nebuchadnezzar. It doesn't tell us how tall it is, but it will allude to how tall it is in a later chapter. It is quite tall, something to the effect of a 10-story building by my calculation. And it certainly depicts a soldier or a warrior of some kind. It represents kingdoms, it represents eras and epochs, and it is made out of multiple metals throughout, or materials throughout. And that's part of the dream that we have been discussing. We started last week. The head of gold, the chest and arms of silver, the belly and the thighs of bronze or copper, as we were discussing before, the legs of iron, and then the feet of clay and iron mixed. And we were in the midst of a discussion about the symbolism of all of that. So more or less, that's where we got into. And what I shared with you last week was sort of the classic approach to this question of what these four kingdoms represent. Just to kind of jump to the end of the dream for a second, at the very end, he sees a stone that comes out of the, I don't know where that stone comes from, but he sees a stone that comes without being hewn by human hands, and it smashes the stone, the clay and the iron, and thereby smashing all of the statues, all of the materials of the statue. And just what I didn't have on the source page last week, I will show you today, which is the other half of that graphic. And just to kind of pull it into perspective, the other half of that graphic is the stone that comes and smashes the statue down. And that's when Nebuchadnezzar wakes up and he sees this great statue with all of its different materials. He sees a stone come and smash it, and he's awakened, and he is greatly disturbed. Okay, so what we had said was we sort of looked at the classic approaches to this these materials. The classic approach is more or less is this articulated by Rashi and a host of midrashim from all over rabbinic literature that sees each of these four items or elements as representing a different era in history. The golden head representing Bavel, the chest and arms representing Persia and Media. It's an interesting split because Persia and Media and Tanakh is always a united kingdom of two nations, Paras and Madai. And so to describe the chest and the two arms as this united kingdom of Persia is just an interesting allusion to the two working together. And then you have the thigh made out of Nechoshet, whether it be bronze or copper, and representing Greece, and then of course the iron legs representing Rome, and eventually the split of Rome is represented by the iron and the clay in the feet, kind of mixing and not mixing, semi-mixed but not mixed, and the that description, one part strong, one part weak, says Rashi is referring to the division within Rome. And then ultimately that leadership or that role of or rule of Edom or Rome will lead us all the way to Yemot HaMashiach, to that stone that represents the Messianic era. And we looked at a bunch of midrashim that all reflect the same idea. Four Malchiyot, four kingdoms representing each of these four stages, Bavel, Paras, Revan, and Edom, Bavel, Persia, Greece, and Rome. And that kind of sweep of history consistent with many of the midrashic descriptions in that you see in the Rishon. Okay, that's where we're up to last week. At the very end of the shiur, I shared with you the basic question. And the basic question, which I think is a critical question, is assuming, and we have no reason at this point to assume otherwise. We will challenge this assumption a little bit later. But for now, we have no reason to assume otherwise that Daniel's vision is in fact a vision that takes us to Yimot HaMashiach, and that we're dealing with the sweep of history and all of the major empires of history. And Daniel is telling Nebuchadnezzar that he's trying to understand what the future holds and what the world will look like and what will be the future Chamit HaYamim. And God gives him this vision of what the Chamit HaYamim is going to look like. We talked about why he merits to have this vision of a Chamit HaYamim, this merit of messianic proportions. And he was exploring this, I'm going to skip back a little bit, and he was exploring this vision, just to kind of go, where is it? This great statue, golden head, etc. The very last stage of it was this stone came and smashed it all. But if it's in fact this giant sweep of all of history, so there's an enormous piece of history that's missing in this vision. And just for anybody who's just joined now, I'm just going to put the sources for today back in the chat. You're welcome to kind of jump on and grab them. All right. And that's the question. And we're going to start with the question as it's articulated by the Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra lived in Spain, 11th, end of 11th, beginning of 12th century. Islamic Spain, and that's part of our issue we're going to talk about momentarily. It's born in Tudela. I gave you on the source page a little bit of a bio both of the Ibn Ezra and of the other commentary I'm going to share with you of Yosef ibn Yahya, just because of the fascinating stories. I don't know how many people know that there is a general perception that the Ibn Ezra, who's traveled around Europe the latter part of his life, maybe even died while he was in England. That's a whole interesting story to itself. The Ibn Ezra writes, this is a very simple question. Yesh li tma, ech lo yizkir Daniel malchut Yishmael, v'lama lo ayu chamesh malchiyot. There's an entire world of the Islamic kingdom, what the Ibn Ezra calls the descendants of Yishmael, but he's talking about it from a religious perspective. Edom, Rome, is typically identified with Christianity in the language of rabbinic literature. And Yishmael is identified with the Islam, not in rabbinic literature. I want to make this very clear. We'll come back to in a moment why rabbinic literature makes no reference to Islam. But the Rishonim certainly did. And the Ibn Ezra's question is very powerful. If you're going to sweep all of history, how could you leave out such an enormous piece, right? If his vision takes us all the way to Yimot HaMashiach, how does he leave out the entire role of the faith of Islam in that description of historic proportion? And so he says, I'm going to reinterpret the story. He says, these four kingdoms don't fit. So he's going to offer a different way of breaking down these kingdoms. And his analysis goes as follows. I apologize, there's no English translation. I looked hard and far to find an English translation of the Ibn Ezra. Could not, at least not readily accessible on the computer. So I'm going to summarize and translate pieces. Da, ki Alexandrus aya melech Yavan, Alexander the Great, was the king of Greece. He, according to Daniel, is the one who kills Darius, the Persian, last Persian king. We'll talk about that. And says the Ibn Ezra, Gam hu aya melech Roma. He also was essentially a descendant of what we will call Rome. Why? Because Roma be'atzma, says the Ibn Ezra, Rome itself was from what in Tanakh is referred to as the Kittim, which is most referenced to the island of Crete. Kasher hora Yosef ben Gurion b'sifro, ubedaniel, himself, he makes reference and says, "Ubao botziim kitim." These ships from Kitim came, and the targum of Kitim is Roma'i, and therefore Kitim is connected not only to Greece but also to Rome. They sort of have a similar derivation, says the Ibn Ezra. And here's the critical piece: Kitim are identified in Sefer Bereishit as one of the children of Yavan. Ubnei Yavan, Elisha, v'Tashish, Kitim, v'Dodanim. And so if Kitim is the origin of both the Greeks and Rome in terms of Edom, in terms of its position, then they both have a link to Yavan. So if that's true, then my third kingdom, namely the Nechoshet, which is Yavan / Kitim / Rome, now I have a combined metal that represents both Greece and Rome, that leaves Habarzel Malchut Yishmael. That leaves the fourth element, namely the iron legs, as the kingdom of Yishmael. Now, he adds an interesting piece to that, which is Bavur ki Malchut Paras Hishchita ko Malchut Kazdim. When Persia took over, they destroyed the entire kingdom of Babel. There was no remnant, there was no part of the kingdom of Persia in which the Babylonian Empire continued to exist. And similarly, when Yavan took over, when the Greek conquest of Persia took place, they literally replaced the Persian Empire, and there was no remnant of the Persian Empire left in the region of Greece. However, that's not true of Yishmael and Edom. Lo yachla machut Yishmael shehu barzel lahashchit machut Yavan rak ktzat machut yishchit. It's not true. When they came to Yishmael and Edom, Rome, they did not replace one another. They kind of coexisted. In a global scheme, they coexisted. And Manasseh, of course, is referencing the fact that in his day, they certainly coexisted. Hine adayom, even till today, yesh mekomot sheYishmael yinatzach malchut Roma, umekomot sheYishmael hu amenutzach. There are some places where Yishmael has conquered Edom and Rome, and other places where Rome has conquered Yishmael, which of course he's referring to sort of the ongoing battles between the worlds or the dominions of Christianity and Islam, and the conflict that sort of on a global scale. And therefore, he says that's the reference in Daniel to the fact that of the two metals, clay, or the two materials, clay and iron, one is stronger than the other. And at certain periods of time, one of these kingdoms would be stronger than the other. That is true in the Nevuah itself. That's why it says, Miktzat Malchut Tehevit Tavira, Umiktzat Tekifa, some of the kingdom will be strong, some of them will be weak. And then it says afterwards, Uviyemehondi Malchaya Inun, in the days of these kingdoms, when that stone comes and destroys the statue to break it and establish this final kingdom, both the previous kingdoms are intact. That's why it says in the days of these kings, that stone will come and break it down. Vatam shtei malchuyot, Roma, shumachut Yavan, umachut Yishmael. These are the two kingdoms that exist till today, Islam and Christianity, or Rome and Yishmael, depending on how you define it. And then the fourth kingdom, of course, the final kingdom, which of course leads us to the world of Yemot HaMashiach. So says the Ibn Ezra. And similar comment by another 16th century Spanish commentary known as Rabbi Yosef Ibn Yahya. And he gets a little even more, spells it out even more dramatically. He has a little bit of a different take on it, however. In his, he doesn't put Yavan and Edom, or Greece and Rome, together, as the Ibn Ezra does. He separates them. However, he jumps one stage, and he says the following. That's we've established. First kingdom is Babel, the second is Persia. That's easy. Nobody disagrees with that. The third is Yavan. I don't think anybody disagrees with that either. Which began with Alexander the Macedonian, who conquered everyone else. The fourth, which here is where the Ibn Ezra had suggested that the fourth was Ishmael because the third had a combined Greece-Rome characteristic, says this particular commentary that the fourth is Rome. Which was eventually divided in half, divided in two. And k'tzato notzrim v'k'tzato ishmaelim. Some of them loyal to Christianity, and some of them becoming loyal to Islam. And therefore, after Edom, you have a split in the iron and the clay of the feet, says Yosef ibn Yahya. That's the Edom and Yishmael combination. And one of the things that Daniel describes in the feet is that the clay and the iron are mixed, but they don't really mix well. They don't stay mixed. And his interpretation is, as most of them are, that they can coexist, but they can't kind of become one. They can't marry each other and assimilate into one another. There are many in the kingdom of Ishmael who live under the rule of Christianity. And even if they don't live under their regime, nonetheless, they'll come to their cities to engage in commerce, to buy and to sell, they'll come to their markets. And similarly, the other way around, there are many Christians who live under an Islamic rule. And he's very, this is 16th century, this is very interesting because his contemporary, his analysis of this comment back into his world is very, very clear. He says, v'nehayom b'Constantina, which of course is a reference to Constantinople, 1,500 ba'alabatim misochrei notzrim ashirim mi Florence, 1,500 Christian visitors, commerce, sellers, people in business, come from Florence and Venice and Geneva and all other parts of the world, and they all intermingle in the great cosmopolitan city. And they respect one another and they treat each other with respect. It's sort of a very interesting depiction of the world. It could be that they don't marry each other because of religious differences. As the Navi describes, that the iron and the clay, they don't mix inherently, but they coexist. So too, that is what you have. The last kingdom is the kingdom of the Messianic King, who reigns not by strength of man, but by God's decree for eternity. And that's the more or less in line with everybody else. So I took that little graphic that we had last week with Rashi's interpretation, and I updated it for you, so you now have a picture of Rashi, Ibn Ezra, and Rabbi Yosef ibn Yahya, kind of the more or less picture of this statue. I would say classic approaches with minor variations. This is what you have. The gold head.
Excuse me. Sorry. Yeah. Can I just say something? I'm really sorry to interrupt you. But, you know, I'm the lady that's written the book on Ibn Ezra. I'm really sorry to have to tell you that he was lived in Christian Spain. I've put it on the chat because I'm not, denying anything you say otherwise. I've double checked. He wrote the book of Daniel in Italy at the same time as the commentary on Torah, which I've written about, and the second one in Rhodes in northern France. Sorry, Rouen in northern France, near where I live. I have actually been to Tudela, where he was born. Although the enclave was Muslim and a tribe, he was surrounded by Christians in Pamplona. And other people like Uriel Simon have also said, I'm not trying to be rude, And I've said
on the contrary, I appreciate your comment, and it won't challenge the thesis.
No,
but I appreciate
definitely
the
not.
Clarification.
But a lot of Americans think Spain was Muslim, because I've been to a lot of these classes now and people won't let me say anything on the whole. They think they know everything, including one English. Not you. You're very nice, but it really is upsetting. It's been my life's work. I'm regarded as the writer on Ibn Ezra in the English language, apart from his poetry and science. And my book is worth reading. It is in the local library in Toronto and in America. And the Rabbinic Council of America have asked me to write an article. I'm not stupid. And the fact is that at that time, in the 11th century, there was the Taifas kingdoms that were fights between Christians and Muslims in Spain. Ibn Ezra and Yehuda Alevi realized there was a problem. And also Ibn Ezra's son converted to Islam without being forced. And that's one reason he was worried. But he had a vision about Daniel. I'm not at all trying to guess at you. I know you're a rabbi. I don't like doing this. But I've put it on the chat and people just ignore the fact that Spain at that time has been conquered.
I will tell you two things. Number one, I do not read the chat during the class because I can't.
No.
But number two, I appreciate your clarification. And the basic question that I'm going to ask, it will not be challenged by what you're saying at all, on the contrary, but the fact whether he lived in Christian Spain or in Islamic Spain, I will take either one. It doesn't matter to me, because what I'm trying to drive is, and that's clearly what he says, is that he knew about Islam.
Yeah.
But he wrote the books
in Christian Europe, one in Rome
and the other in northern France.
Yeah.
That notwithstanding, the issue what Ibn Ezra is suggesting and Rabbi Yossi Ibn Yahya are suggesting is that if Daniel, and this is the big if Daniel is a sweep of history till the days of Yemot HaMashiach, you can't ignore Islam. Okay? And that's the theory. And so whether or not Greece and Rome come together under one category, namely the thighs, and Yishmael is the iron, and then they share the world in the bottom of the iron and clay feet. They share history until Yemot HaMashiach, as Ibn Ezra suggests, or as Ibn Yahya suggests, that the thighs represent Greece, the iron represents Rome, and then eventually the feet and the iron clay together represent Islam and Christianity sharing the world. According to all of them, the world history till Yemot HaMashiach is essentially the story divided between Islam and Christianity. And therefore, the question, and I'll come to the question, somebody's going to ask me about the Far East. I'll come to that in a second.
But they're right, there have been other empires as well, which have...
100%. We're going to address all those questions. That's exactly
communism
the question.
Communism and stuff today. Like that. Yeah.
Just hang on a second. And that's basically where they're coming from. So I want to deal with two questions. First question is, so how to come, and this one is a bit of a straw man question, because it's really not a question at all. It's what we used to call in the yeshiva klutz kasha. It's really not a question at all. How come, not so much for Rashi, but how come the Midrashim all universally, every Midrash I shared with you, ignores the role of Yishmael or the role of Islam in all of this? That's not a hard question to answer. Because Chazal, the Talmud, the Talmud is concluded in the 6th century of the Common Era. Muhammad is in the year 610, in the 7th century of the Common Era. Chazal never saw Islam. They didn't know about Islam. And so, whereas the Ibn Ezra and Ibn Yahya, who lived through it, who saw it, who understood it, who said that this, if Daniel is a vision up until Yemot HaMashiach, it has to be included. Chazal never had such a challenge, because in their world, the only empire that existed beyond the scope was Rome at the time. So from that perspective, you know, that question, I think it's a powerful question. But Ibn Ezra's questions, perhaps on Rashi, is on some of the other early commentaries, wouldn't have had this question on Chazal, because Chazal never knew about Islam. Right? There's no rabbinic literature about Islam at all, because it predates it. Chazal predate the story of Islam historically. Okay. Be that as it may, I think it was Julian who asked the question. Be that as it may, there's a much bigger question to ask. And the much bigger question to ask, in my opinion, is Daniel really taking us on a sweep of history that's going to take us all the way to Yemot HaMashiach, to the Messianic era? There are enormous gaps in world history that are not included in either Rome or Ishmael or Christianity or Islam. You have the entire dominion of the Far East, which certainly from a religious perspective don't fit into either. I'm going to actually stop sharing for a second. That don't fit into either of these categories. You have contemporary empires. All the empires of the 20th century, I don't think fit neatly into any of these categories. The whole modern world is a different arena. And so if, in fact, Daniel is taking us all the way to a vision of Yemot HaMashiach by the definition of these materials and kingdoms in this vision, as universally understood by almost all the commentaries, we're left with a challenge, which is how to understand whether I take one approach or the other approach. I'm going to start pulling all of these empires and reading them into the various pieces of Daniel's very concise vision. We are going to be left with holes. So what I'm going to share with you, and we're going to do it over 2 weeks. We're going to start today, and then we're going to finish B'ezrat Hashem next week. And remind everybody, if you weren't there when we started the call, that this class has now been extended, open-ended. And so we will be continuing next week. The registration stays open. And I hope you will all come back, because we will not finish the subject today. We will, B'ezrat Hashem, finish it next week.
What are the empires of the 19th century?
I mean, you have in the 20th century, you have the West, and you have the Soviet Union, and you have lots of major powers that exist in the world in history.
And you have the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
What I'm suggesting to you is it becomes very problematic to subsume every empire or every major superpower that's ever existed in the world under one of two umbrellas, Rome or Ishmael. I don't think that fits neatly. And I think to do so is to squeeze a square hole in a round peg. And it could very well be that the Rishonim, that's what they knew, that's what they saw, that's what they experienced, or that was the influence of the interpretation of a key phrase, which we're going to talk about momentarily. But what I would like to do is start with a challenge to our basic assumption. So we're going to challenge one of the core basic assumptions of our interpretation now, and how that plays back into Sefer Daniel, we'll look at next week. But I want to come back to the text for a second. It all starts from one key phrase. In Pasuk Chavchet, Daniel makes the following introduction to his vision. Yesh Eloah b'shamayim megaleh razim. There is a God in heaven who reveals secrets. V'odiyah l'melech Nebuchadnezzar ma she'yeh be'acharit hayamim. And he has made known to Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the acharit hayamim. Translated most commonly as at the end of days. Bacharit Yumai. This phrase, Bacharit Yamim, is going to be the subject of the rest of today's shiur. What does the phrase mean? It's ubiquitous. It appears everywhere, in all the Nevi'im, in nevuot and prophecies of eschatological nature. We're going to, in Chumash too. We're going to, and I got lots of sources, so hang on. I want to start with a basic question. It is almost always translated as the end of days, Acharit HaYamim. I want to raise the question. Could it have an alternative? And if so, what does that alternative mean? So let's take a quick glance through, for example, the most famous phrase, location of that phrase, not necessarily the first by any stretch of the imagination. Its first use is in Sefer Breshit, by Yaakov. But the most famous application of the phrase is probably from Yeshayahu Perek Bet. That's probably the most known of all references. And there, Pasuk says, the vision that was given to Yeshayahu ben Amoz, Vayab acharit hayamim, it shall come to pass at the end of days. Again, it is almost always translated thus. Nachon Yahar Beit Hashem Berosh Harim, the mountain of God shall be established on the tops of all mountains and exalted above the hills, and all the nations shall flow to it. From the world of Kol Goyim, and nations shall come and say, we will go with you, we'll go up to the house of God of Jacob, of Beit Elokei Yaakov. And Kimitzion Tetzei Torah Dvar Hashem Yishalayim, famously, the Zion shall go forth, Torah, the law, from God, word of God from Yishalayim, the vision of what is kind of identified as almost the classic nevuah of Yeshayahu v'Yamot HaMashiach begins with a time frame. Namely, this will occur acharit hayamim, end of days. Okay. Well, let's take a quick look at its first usage. The term acharit hayamim appears not just in the Nevi'im, and it appears in almost every Navi, and I'll give you at the end of the shiur today a list of all the places where the phrase, or many of the places where the phrase appears, but its first use is actually in the story of Yaakov. Yaakov, and I'm jumping back to the source page, I apologize for jumping around a little bit today. Vayikra Yaakov el banav, Yaakov calls over his children, and he says to them, He'asfu ve'agid alachem et asher yikra atchem acharit hayamim. Gather to my hand, and I will tell you what will happen. Now, I've modified the translations here because, unfortunately, the source that I pulled for this translation does not translate acharit hayamim consistently in every instance. And I think that's a mistake. Same phrase needs to be translated consistently in the same way. So we'll get to that issue. But Yaakov says to them, gather and I will tell you what will be acharit hayamim, the end of days. Similarly, we have a nevuah by Bilam in Parshat Balak, in Bamidbar, Perek Chaf Dalet. When Bilam turns to Balak and he says to him, Hineni olech la'ami, I'm going home to my people. But before I go, lecha yatzcha sheyaseh ha'am hazeh le'amcha b'acharit hayamim. Know what this nation will do to your people at the end of days. Similarly, in Devarim, Perek Lamed Aleph, in Hazinu, Moshe is told to give to this a particular text, the Shira of Hazinu, to Bnei Israel as a testimony because Yadati Acharimoti, I know that after I die, says Moshe to the people, Hashchet Tashchitun, you will corrupt yourselves and you will veer from the path that God has commanded you. The Karata Etchem Ara'ah, all of this evil will have come to you v'acharit hayamim, in the end of days. You will anger God. And therefore, I'm sharing with you the story of Hazim. Again, there are other ways to translate it. I'm going to come back to that. But for now, I'm translating it all in a consistent pattern. So Yaakov, let's start with Yaakov. Let's deal with Yaakov's case, because that's the first instance that it appears. And as Nachum Leibowitz has taught many, used to teach many times, the best way to find the meaning of a term is always in its first application. So what was Yaakov doing on his deathbed? He gathers his children over together and he says, I'm going to share with you that which will happen b'acharit hayamim, at the end of days. So did Yaakov reveal to his children a vision that was messianic in nature? Did he share with his children on his deathbed a vision of what will occur at the end of time?
I thought he was blessing his children.
Well, okay, we call them brachot. Yaakov called them prophecies. Unclear. Now, one of the centerpieces around that discussion is one of the psukim, which is a pasuk to Yehuda, in which it says, "Lo yasur shevet miyuda mochokek miben raglav ad ki yavo shilo velo yikatamim." The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver or leader from between his loins, meaning he will always establish the sense, he will always lead the people of Israel until he comes, or again, this phrase is somewhat debated how to translate it, until he either comes to Shiloh or until Shiloh arrives. What is this Shiloh? If it's the city of Shiloh, where the Mishkan was, well, that was destroyed long before David became king. What's its connection? And Rashi there says that Shiloh is a name for Melech HaMashiach. The word Shiloh means Melech HaMashiach. Shehamilucha Shiloh. And similarly, Targum translates it that way, the one who is king. Ad Kievo Shiloh. In other words, says Rashi, this phrase means Judah shall be the leader of Israel all the way till Yomot HaMashiach, till the days of Mashiach. Ad Kievo Shiloh. Most Mefarshim actually translate the phrase differently, but Rashi is influenced by his consistent position, which is that Yaakov, on his deathbed, turned to his children and said, I'm going to share with you a vision of what's going to be Achrit Yamim, the end of days. The problem is he doesn't. He tells them nothing about what's going to be B'Yamot HaMashiach.
Because I thought Rashi says somewhere there we're going to get there.
Says Rashi, therefore I have a problem. On the one hand, Yaakov says, I'm going to tell my children what's going to be B'Yamot HaMashiach. And on the other hand, he doesn't do it. So Rashi quotes the Medrash Rabbah and says, "Bikesh l'galot et haketz," that he wanted to, he intended to, and he began his the perek pasuk aleph. He intended to share with the people, the children, what will be b'yimot haMashiach. However, nistalka shchina mimenu, but the divine presence, referring to the power of prophecy that he had at that moment, departed from him, and therefore he was. He had this vision, he was going to say it, and it was on the tip of his tongue, and he swallowed it. And he couldn't do it. Just literally, it went poof, like a dream, like Nebuchadnezzar's dream. It just disappeared. And the Shekhinah departed from him and began to tell him other things. Because, of course, it says he'll tell him what it'll be. Similarly, the Ramban says, "Ba'achrit yamim hem yomot haMashiach," that this is a reference to the days of Messianism. Ki Yaakov yirmoz elav b'dvarav, Yaakov will hint to events that will occur at that time, as it says, for example, "Ad ki yavo Shiloh b'lo yikat amim," which is a reference to Yomot haMashiach, says the Ramban. Our rabbis tell us, Gemara Pesachim, that he wanted to reveal the end, but it was removed from him. Because everybody agrees that the phrase Acharit HaYamim refers to the days of Mashiach. That's universally accepted, says Ramban. Everybody agrees to that. And therefore, I have to figure out what Yaakov is talking about. That's more or less where the starting point is. The problem is, it's not so clear that everybody agrees that Acharit HaYamim is Yomot HaMashiach. That's not so. It's not, commentaries typically would often talk in the hyperbole of everybody agrees to this because they wanted to make their point. But the reality is that not every one of the commentaries suggests that this phrase has a eschatological connotation, or that this phrase means end of days, meaning days of Mashiach. So, for example, here's a commentary known as Rabbi Avram ben Aramba. Now, again, I searched high and low for computer available English translations of these three. I could not find them, so I'm going to translate them on the fly. I did find bios, so I give you the bios of each of these three commentaries that I'm going to share with you, so you have them on the bottom of the page. But Rabbi Avram ben Rambam literally was that. He was the son of the Rambam. He took over his father's position as the head of the Jewish community in Egypt, as well as a physician, wrote a number of very important works. He wrote a commentary on Chumash. He wrote a book of Jewish thought and philosophy. And he writes the following. Umamaro b'Acharit HaYamim, this statement that Acharit HaYamim that Yaakov says is because shehabrachot kshurot b'matzavam asher achar yitziat Mitzrayim u'b'yirushat ha'aretz. Because Yaakov was talking about the state of the Jewish people after they leave Egypt and they come into the land of Israel and they settle in the land. And the simplest pshat of understanding Yaakov's brachot was that he was assigning territory to each tribe where each tribe would be geographically in the land of Israel. And therefore his reference was not to Matzavam be'eretz Mitzrayim, not what they would experience in Egypt, but what they would experience after they come back from Egypt. But that has nothing to do with the days of Messianism, Yemot HaMashiach. Very far from it. Or the Netziv. Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, to get a little more contemporary, was the 19th century, was the head of the yeshiva of Volozhin. The Netziv writes in his commentary, a very important commentary called Hamakdaba, and he writes very clearly, despite what the Ramban writes, "Dibemet ein mashmaut ba'acharit ha'amim b'chol makom ayomot ha'mashiach." Not true that every place where the phrase "acharit ha'amim" comes or appears, it refers to the time of Mashiach. That is not so. I'm going to challenge that assumption, says the Nitziv. And he says, "Go back to Parsha Vayelech, to the quote that I shared with you earlier with the Dvarim Lamed Aleph." It says there that Moshe says to them, "Bekarata etchem hara'am acharit hayamim," that the evil calamity will occur at the time of acharit hayamim, meaning you will sin and therefore be punished. That's not Yemot HaMashiach, that's the opposite. Or Yaakov Avinu on his deathbed. He talks lots about things that will not be the case in the time of Mashiach coming. For example, he says Zvulun will be on the coast. Zvulun b'lochof yamim mishkon. And in Sefer Yechezkel, Zvulun is not on the coast. B'chelukat Sefer Yechezkel in Okein. So that's certainly not going to be the case all the way up to Yemot HaMashiach. Or Bilam. Bilam says to Balak, this is what your people will do to this people, b'achrit yamim. This is what you, Balak, king of Moab, are going to do to my people, to this people at the time of Acharit Yamin. And ze eno b'mot HaMashiach shekvar batla b'ne'ekra umat Moab min olam. That certainly can't be a reference to Yemot HaMashiach because Moab is no longer. So what does Acharit Yamin mean? Ala mashmut Acharit Yamin. Sof yemei tkufa shehamedaber omed bo. It means, it's an extraordinary statement. The phrase simply means the end of whatever period of history the speaker is speaking from. The end of this epoch, the end of this era is called the Acharit HaYamim. I'm intentionally not translating the phrase because I'm going to retranslate it at the end of the shiur today.
Could mean but, who's going to win the World Cup, right?
Well, it doesn't have to be, it can be a little more significant, but yes, who had the I'll define it in a second, but I just want to say, my point here is that what the Ramban takes as a given, that every place the phrase Acharit HaYamim appears, everybody agrees it's a reference to time of messianism, as we call it, says that's not so. It simply means the next period of time. Whatever period we're in, whoever the speaker is, the next period, the future, is that's what we're referring to as Acharit HaYamim. Shadal, also Shmuel David Lutzato, 19th century scholar, similarly says Acharit HaYamim simply means Hayamim Abayim, the days to come, or Bayamim Achronim, the days that are next, meaning Acharon Sheacharei Acharon. There is next, and there's next after next. For example, Leah and her children were described as Leah b'yaladei achronim, that Yaakov placed his children in sequence, and Leah and her children after them. And there were children after that, right? Rachel and her children after that. V'kol ma she'enenu rishon yikra achron. The word achron doesn't mean last, it means next. Whoever's not first is next. It talks about various derivations of the term. I'm going to skip some of that. And so he concludes, Yaakov's intention here was about the division of the land of Israel, not about the eschatological vision of Yimot HaMashiach. So if that's true, and I can refer to Acharit HaYamim, referring to the next period of history or the next stage of history or some other reference like that, then what do I do with all of these Nevuot? What do I do with Yirmiyahu, who says, V'shavti shvut Mo'ab b'acharit hayamim, ne'um Hashem, ad hena mishpat Mo'ab. I will bring back the captivity of Mo'ab and in acharit hayamim, in the end of days, and judge Mo'ab. Mo'ab doesn't even exist anymore. Or Yechezkel, V'alita al ami Yisrael ke'anan chasot ha'aretz b'acharit hayamim, referring to the war of Gog and Magog. You will advance upon my people like a cloud covering the earth. This shall happen. Acharit hayamim tiyeh. This will be acharit hayamim. We did this after of Chol HaMoed Pesach, if I'm not mistaken. Or Hosea. Achai yeshuvu bnei Yisrael v'kshu et Hashem elokeihem et David malkam u'pachadu al Hashem be'el tuvo b'acharit hayamim. The children of Israel shall return. They shall seek God. They shall seek David their king and shall come trembling to God in the end of days. B'acharit hayamim. But Daniel, you saw one reference. Here's another reference. U'bati la'vincha t'shikra le'amcha b'acharit hayamim. I have come to help you. The Malach says to Daniel, I have come to share a vision with you of what will occur to your people ba'acharit hayamim. Ki od chazon l'yamim, for there is yet a vision for the days. Acharit hayamim, the end of days. So what are we talking about?
It sounds like it means in the future.
That's...
But the future is different for different speakers.
Okay. Well,
and what... and different times of the people when they're hearing the message.
Yeah, that's what the Nitziv was trying to say. Right, at the end of the period of the speaker is referring to as Yachrit Hayamim. This is a game changer. This is a reevaluation of not only linguistics, not only terms and translations, but our whole perspective on Tanakh. I can't even begin to tell you how much this is going to reorient our understanding of every chapter of Tanakh. But we're going to do that next week. So you'll have to come back. I want to jump to what I think is probably the clearest articulation of what these words mean. And it appears in a comment of the Ibn Ezra in the following context. So let's start with this pasuk in Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu, in his in one parak says, Agidu ha'otuyot le'achor. Now, don't be careful about the translation. That doesn't mean describe the read the letters backwards. That's not what he's what the words mean. The word otiyot here refers to that which comes. Ki ata boker, right? The morning will come, right? The notion of that which occurs, that which happens, otot, otiyot, right? That which will happen. Tell what will happen le'achor. Not sure what la'achor here means. We're going to see in a second. V'nei da'a, and we will know. Yaloim atem, aftetivu v'tereu, v'nishtav, v'nirei yachdav. Then we will know what you are. Then we may know that you are gods, do anything good or bad, that we may be awed and see it. And he's talking to the idolaters, to the pagans, and he's saying to them, you want to tell me you're a real god, so tell me what's going to happen in the future. So tell me what's going to happen in the future. Agidu otot l'achor. Compare that to the following phrase, which appears in Megillat Rut, which is describing customs that existed in an earlier time from the authorship of the Sefer, describing how they used to transact transactions. V'zot lefanim b'Yisrael. This was the practice in the earlier times of Israel. whenever they would try to exchange or exempt or redeem or do some sign of transaction, they would take a shoe off and they would give it over. They would have what we would today call a kinyan, a transaction, kinyan chalipin. That was referred to as lefanim b'Yisrael in the earlier times of Israel. Or Shmuel Aleph Perek Tet, where it talks about referring to Shmuel as a chozer rather than as a navi. Ki lefanim b'Yisrael ko'amar ish b'lechtol lidrosh elokim l'chu ben achad haro'eh. It was in the past, in the earlier times, when a person would say, we want to inquire of a man of God, they would call him a ro'eh. Ki lenavi ayom yikare lefanim haro'eh. What we call today a navi, in earlier times was called a seer. So the linguistic comment in the middle of Sefer Shmuel. Says Yevon Ezra, this really, I think, articulates the core of it. Tam ha'atidot haba'ot l'achor. Hu hazman haba. Ki hazman she'avar yikare lefanim. The word in Tanakh for the future is the word achor. And the word in Tanakh for the past is the word lefanim. And then he's explaining the context in the pasuk in Yeshayahu.
Logically, I'm sorry to interrupt, but logically, it's the opposite.
I'll explain the logic to it in a second. Just give me a second. I want to put the thesis out there, and then I'll explain it. I have 5 minutes. Give me one moment. Yeshayahu magid mereshit acharit. I will tell the future. I foretell the future from the past. Magid mereshit acharit. From that which is in the past, I tell the future. Magid mereshit acharit. Umikedem asher lo nasu. Or Yirmiyahu. I know the deeds of man. Nachshavot shalom v'lo l'ra'ah. Intentions for peace and not for calamity. Latet lechem acharit v'tikva. To give you a future and a hope. Acharit v'tikva. Or in Kohelet, the fool who says, lo yadeh ha'adam ma sheyeh, man cannot know what will be, ba'asher yeh me'acharav mi'agid lo, and who's going to tell him what the future holds, me'acharav. Okay. So, in the 5 minutes I have left, let me explain very simply the world view of Tanakh. In this word, which is the exact opposite of the English language. In the English language, your past is behind you and your future is in front of you. In the language of Tanakh, we walk through time backwards. Let me say that again. In the language of Tanakh, we walk through time backwards. That which we can see is in front of us. None of us have eyes behind our heads. And therefore, in the frame of reference of Tanakh, that which is lefanim, which is in front of us, is the past. And that which is me'achor, which is behind us, is the future. We walk through time backwards. Everybody understand? That is the past. That is the future. Which means that when the Navi says, you want to look at the future, the Navi says, tell the event of me'achor, hagidu otiot me'achor, tell what's behind you. The Navi has the power to glance over his shoulder and look at the future. The rest of us human beings, we have, you know, it's fascinating, the English phrase, you know the English phrase, 20/20 hindsight. It's an absurdity, right? What does it mean? It means that when looking back on events, we have 20/20 vision. You have 20/20 vision of what's in front of you. That's Tanakh. In Lefanim, that which you can see is the future. Is the past. Now, you can draw conclusions from the past. You can analyze the past. You can say, okay, well, if this happened in the past, then this must be what's coming up along the road, and make changes and make behavioral patterns, adjustments based on what you think is coming because of what you've seen. So there's a brick wall behind you and you miss it completely because you don't have a rear view mirror. The Navi has a rear view mirror. It's called Nevuah. The rest of us go through time backwards. And that's exactly the language of Tanakh. Hagidu otiyot le'achor. Loznecha tishmana davar me'acharecha. Your ears will hear that which is in the future. And therefore, the phrase acharit hayamim doesn't mean end of days. It simply means the future days. Some time in the future. Now, how far into the future is the question we're going to ask next week. But the word itself doesn't mean end. The word itself means future. It's the opposite of lefanim. If lefanim means past, it doesn't mean the beginning of time. It means sometime in the past. Achor or acharit means sometime in the future. But at no point does the phrase itself mean end, as it does in modern Hebrew. And that's the translation piece. The best way to translate achorit hayamim is in latter days, future days, sometime after, in the language of the Netziv, sometime after the current period of history. How far into the future? That remains in context. And that's the question we're going to have to explore next week. If this theory is true, what does that do for every nevuah that begins, it will be v'haya b'acharit hayamim? What does it do for Yeshayahu's nevuah about the Har HaBayit and acharit hayamim? What does it do for Yirmiyahu's nevuah of acharit hayamim, or Yechezkel's nevuah of acharit hayamim? And what does it do for Daniel's vision of the statue in the four kingdoms that are a vision of what acharit hayamim is? Or to put it simply, how far into the future did Daniel really see? That's the question we have to explore. Bezrat Hashem, that's the question we're going to explore next week. So you're all invited back to join us for session number 7, even though that was originally only 6, but now we've kind of open-ended it. And we will continue our march through the Sefer. I have a few extra minutes if people want to stay and ask questions. I'm happy to. I know I kind of, at the last minute, I cut off a question or two, but I just wanted to make sure I got the thesis out there and into the public domain. And, I'm happy to take a few minutes for questions if people want.
Kvod Rav, the Natsim lived in the 19th century.
Yeah.
Right? So, and he wrote this about the future days or the nearby future days for Achrit HaYamin. So, it's a changing complete the outlook of Yemot HaMashiach.
You're still making an assumption that I'm not making. And you're still linking the phrase Achrit HaYamin to Yemot HaMashiach. So my intention next week is to sever that link.
Okay, so I'll wait for next week.
Correct. The phrase Achrit HaYamin, what I'm suggesting, does not mean Yemot HaMashiach. It means sometime in the future. What's it talking about? We'll talk, we'll see. That's the question we have to explore. But what we call Yemot HaMashiach is a whole different concept.
Thank you very much.
Because why can't you simply say Lifnei? Everybody knows Lifnei means before. And achar kach or acharei means after.
So yeah, it's just a very poetic way of saying achar kach. It's a very, it's exactly the same meaning. Lifnim or lifnei, it's just grammatically a smichut to yamim. So instead of saying acharei yamim rabim, as it says in some places, right? It says acharit yamim or acharit yamim. It's a very poetic tool, but I think that's exactly what it means. Some future time.
Can I go back, because I feel that people were upset that I interrupted about Ibn Ezra. It's just that you are the most accessible and friendly of all the people that have spoken about Ibn Ezra. Every time I've tried, the point about the Spain is there were some parts that never became Muslim. You are right about the thesis, but the whole point was it was invaded, as you know, from North Africa. And then it really went wrong. It had been Muslim, and they also got into what we now call the south of France in the year 800 CE, and there was a real problem. And so Provence, which is in the south of France, was more like Spain than northern France that was part with England, because I'm a historian. And that's why Ibn Ezra, as you correctly said, came to England, where he was murdered in a pogrom by crusaders just outside London in Epping Forest on their way to the so-called Holy Land. I know your talk is not about Ibn Ezra, it's about Daniel. But when he had his vision, when he wrote the book of Daniel, he thought that in hundreds of years, he's writing in about 1155, in hundreds of years, the Jews, although they were slightly better off under Islam, would find solace in some Christian countries. He didn't know the term Protestant, but it turned out they did get into Holland and England, you know, which then were slightly more accessible maybe than now. And of course, we all know Jews do better in America apart from Israel than that. But, you know, he didn't think of that. The man was an absolute visionary. He was an absolute visionary, and his book on, I'm so glad you've done the Daniel. I do have a few translations into English in my book, but mainly on the Torah. So that's all I wanted to say was that.
I appreciate you coming very much. And I would love to find the time to review your book, but you know, it's fascinating, fascinating observations. Mm. Thank you very much.
I loved what you said about Ahari. I thought it was brilliant and really a thrilling, thrilling series. I look forward and will recommend you. And I hope there's no bad feeling with people in Canada. I know Canadians are very polite, but you know, I just feel that because you did say, and you got the dates right, most people get them wrong and say he died 1167. But you know, the Spanish government had us all over on his anniversary in 1989, his 900th.
I will admit to my ignorance. Most of my facts and history of that kind of nature come from somewhere on the internet. But I appreciate your
well. That's why I'm so glad to meet someone like you who is so open. It's very rare. It's extremely rare, and I really appreciate it. And thank you so much. All the best. Bye.
Thank you, Rabbi. It was really wonderful. Very inspiring.
My pleasure. I hope to see you all next week.
Thank you.
We're very happy that you're continuing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.